Me too.
All right, let's go get it. Welcome everybody to the second episode of Voices for Excellence, this podcast series, which we are fully immersed in season one, but episode two. And the title or the focus for this is Revolutionizing Education in the AC Stage of Education, Leadership Tips and Strategies. And it was easy in my case to identify this individual when we talk about revolutionizing education, specifically around what does that look like for tips and strategies as you move your leadership into this very novel stage of the AC Stage of Education. So the person I have invited and asked them passionately to be the to be on this podcast series, and he just said yes, just right off the bat. And it is absolutely my honor to bring Mr. Richard A. Carranza. I just wanted to say, I'm so glad you can hear my voice to have Richard on this podcast series. Not only does he serve as a mentor for me, but he is more importantly a friend and what I call my hermano, mi hermano. So Richard, it is so great to have you on.
Michael, it's an honor to be on with you, hermano, and thank you for the invitation. Look forward to our conversation.
Absolutely. And just to give a brief background of yourself, Richard serves right now as the Chief of Strategy and Global Development for IXL Learning, and he's also the founder and CEO of Carranza Educational Consulting, LLC. But this is where I know Richard's work from. And he has really helped me as I went through this trajectory from starting as a classroom practitioner all the way up to my superintendency. I've been following Richard's work since he was a deputy superintendent in San Francisco Public Schools. Went from being the deputy from San Francisco, you know, you was hearing, you know, on the West Coast, this guy talking about equity when equity work wasn't even a definition of education. Okay, so that's when Richard was bringing it. Then to becoming the superintendent of San Francisco Public Schools, moved on to be the superintendent of the Houston Independent School District in Houston, Texas, and then most recently served as the chancellor of New York City Public Schools in New York City. So like I said, it's just an absolute honor. And to me, he is the equity warrior of the country within education. So I have to start out with this question, Richard. And I completely stole this from Dr. Tracy Davis, former superintendent in Reno Public Schools, but I had to ask you this question. So Richard, when you walk into a room, when people hear you speak, when people engage with you, whether you as the superintendent of San Francisco, Houston, or chancellor of New York City Public Schools, when you walk in the room, Richard, what is your equity song that defines you and why?
Man, that's a great question. There's so many. You know, I'm a mariachi, right? I'm a mariachi musician. So the first thing that goes through my mind are all of the Vicente Fernandez songs. You know what? I thought of the perfect song. And if you don't mind, I'm going to play it for you.
Oh, please.
I'm going to actually play it for you.
Love it. So love it.
It's going to be in Spanish, and then I'll tell you what it means in English, okay? Here we go. Let me see.
Hoy me reclamaron por venir a ver. No quieren que vuelva por aquí jamás. Dicen que si vuelvo encontraré la muerte, que por ti la vida me van a quitar. A mí no me asustan tipos lenguas largas que solo presumen para pantallar. Yo soy de los hombres que no temen nada, aunque esté perdido.
I've just seen a whole bunch of verses, but let me just tell you, that's a Vicente Fernandez song called "No Me Sé Rajar," and in Spanish that means "I just don't know how to quit." And the verses kind of, you know, talk about, you know, people are telling me that I shouldn't be coming to see you. They don't want me to come back here ever again. They say if I return, I will surely find my death. That for you, my life, you're going to take it away. And then the chorus kind of says, I'm not afraid by big talkers who only talk because they want to act tough. They only talk when they want to be tough, but I will never back away because I don't know how to play. So when you ask me that question, what's my walk-in song, my walk-in equity song, I would have to say I'm going to go with Vicente Fernandez, No Me Sé Rajar, because in this kind of work, it's full contact. And especially when people hear things they probably don't want to hear, they're going to tell you, you need to back up. Who are you to tell me? And if you believe it, you should stick to your guns. So No Me Sé Rajar.
Richard, that means a lot to me because when I hear that, right, as a leader, superintendent, a principal, a deputy, I just don't know how to quit, right? And when we look at this now, right, and taking that from your equity song, and you, I've heard you speak about this so eloquently, right? The Jeffersonian model, the industrial model emulation, right? And in order to really reverse the cycle that Black and Brown students engage in on a regular basis, now we have a permission or an opportunity to transform or reimagine what this Jeffersonian model looks like. But we need leaders that just don't know how to quit. So for leaders out there, where should we start disrupting this Jeffersonian model that you talk about, the education bureaucracies and hierarchies that inhibits the progress of all?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's a $1 million question, Michael, but what I would say is that this is my perspective. If you're not gonna fight for kids, for all kids, then don't be a leader. There's a lot of things you can do where you don't have to put yourself out there and actually fight for kids. And if you're gonna be a leader, you have to understand that you are inherently going to be taking on systems and structures that have been crafted to promulgate a permanent underclass. So we talk about the Jeffersonian model. You know, Thomas Jefferson talked about the educational model early, early in this country's history. And he said that there should be a two-tiered system of education, one for the learned and one for the laboring. And that if we were successful, we might be able to rake a few geniuses from the rubbish. Now think about that and think about how do students, particularly students of color, English language learners, students with disabilities, how have they done in the public school system in America? So either we as educators and leaders say it's the kids, Black and Brown kids just biologically, physiologically, genealogically cannot perform academically, because there's a lot of evidence that they're not performing well. So it's the kids for all of those reasons. Or perhaps it's the systems, the structures, the barriers that we've created and baked into the very systems that we now are charged with leading that are preventing some, if not all, kids from being successful. And it's the kids, and I would say the adults, that have figured out how to circumvent those obstacles and how to play the system, given the way it's set up, that have particular success in those systems. So if you don't believe me, look at every school system in America, and you will find that somewhere in that school system, there are systems and structures that do not benefit all students. In fact, they privilege some students at the expense of other students. Now, some people are gonna say, wow, that's just a really, really ugly perception on what public education is. On the contrary, I'm a huge believer in public education, but I'm also a huge believer that all children should have access to all of the benefits in a public school system. And I'll tell you, in my experience, when you're in charge of a school, easy, easy ride. Just do what's always been done. Don't rock the boat. Shake the hands. Make the visits. Slap the backs. And you will have a really easy tenure. But start asking the hard question. Why do we do what we do? what's the research that shows this is what's best for kids? Why do some students not have these opportunities? Why don't we do this so that more kids have these opportunities? You start asking those hard questions, what's going to invariably happen is that there are entrenched interests then that will start pushing back. And what I have found is that it very quickly becomes not about the professional questions you're asking, it becomes about personal. That they'll come after you and who you are, and you become the racist, and you become the unqualified professional. So as a leader, you just have to understand that number one, you should be going after those hard questions, but once you do, just understand that the status quo will push back against it.
Richard, just the way you just phrased it and contextualized it, just a lot to unwrap there. In episode one, Dr. Marrero, Alex Marrero, actually gave the reference of the Learn It, and he even explained that's how it's pronounced, right? The labor and some will make it from the rubbish. And just to hear you, the author of that, right? And now some of these impactful leaders across the country are using your words and integrating into your practice or integrating into their practices is just absolutely phenomenal. But I want to get back to what you stated, asking the hard questions, right? And you and I, you know how we are analytically, even brought to ground, you know, systems redesign, right? Mm-hmm. And we ask questions, and I like to say in a descriptive manner, a prescriptive manner, a diagnostic manner, but to get to those hard questions around equity and anti-marginalization are those catalytic questions, right? And once you start asking those questions, as you stated, you're going to take your bumps and bruises. You and I have first experienced this because we asked those hard questions around Black and Brown students, around EL students, so that all can be able to promulgate within this historical Jeffersonian model that we're trying to dismantle. But to eradicate those, I like to call educational inhibitors, right, for true liberalization, those bumps are going to happen. You're going to have those nights where I can admit, you know, Richard, I had nights, sleepless nights. I would cry myself to sleep. I would say, I can't believe that this is happening. And then you have high blood pressure, right? You're trying to figure out what that balance looked like. Richard, somebody that went through that in New York, in Houston, in San Francisco, because you're about all. And we know that this is going to come to us as leaders. It's just, what does that look like on scale? You took it at the biggest scale, Richard. And that's why a lot of leaders thank you and follow you for this. But from your own words, right, what advice would you give leaders, specifically Black and Brown leaders that are doing this, to stay in the public sector space and to keep fighting for families and students?
Yeah, well, I appreciate what you just said, Michael. Thank you. But what I would say to my brothers and sisters that are still in the seat and still in the fight, who else do those children have to fight for them? I mean, they have their parents, but you get to make decisions. You get to drive policy in a way that those children need. So more than ever, we need egalitarian-minded, enlightened leaders that are willing to call the question. And the question really is what we're doing good for all children, or is it good for some children? And I think, you know, the pushback comes because, and I don't fault parents whatsoever. On the contrary, I think that the more we empower parents with knowledge, the more they're going to be able to advocate for their children. But there are parents that have figured out the system. They figured out how to play the game. So when you start moving the system to a much more equity-centered system where there's more opportunities for more students, there is a sense in some circles that you're taking something away from parents because they figured it out. So now you're opening it up to more people. So what about my kids? And I figured it out. So that scarcity mindset is something that we also have to take on. And help parents to understand that more opportunities mean more opportunities for everybody. It doesn't mean less opportunities for just your children. And I think that if there was anything that I would do differently in New York City, it's I would have paid more attention to that particular aspect of the change process, making sure that parents understand why is it that we're moving in this direction and why is that good for your child as well as everybody else's child as well.
Thank you for that, Richard, because the why, right? And that mm-hmm. scarcity mindset to moving to equity-centered learning environments, equity-centered systems for all. Now, to underscore that, Richard, we know your practice and work with regards to really equalizing the opportunities for all, right? But in a simplistic form for our audience today, what is your definition of equity, right? That's just one. And then now, because we have a holistic or a comprehensive audience from the superintendent level all the way down to the practitioner level, i.e. teachers, I want you to outline equity with strategies in four different domains so that all of our audience can really create this coherence around the definition or your definition of equity. So we'll start with the first. How would you define equity?
Yeah, so for me, it's very simple. So we set a level of expectation or a bar that we want all students to reach. And, you know, that's a community conversation. That's a strategic conversation within each community. But you set the bar. This is what we want all students at the minimum to be able to do. And then equity is what we do to help all students meet that bar. And for some students, it's going to look different than for other students. Some students have the benefit of a nuclear family. Some students have the benefit of a don't have the academic skills that they should have had already to be able to meet that bar. So equity means you do whatever it takes to help all students meet the bar that you've set. It's not about lowering the bar. It's not about a different bar for different groups of students. It's about everybody being able to meet the bar that we've set. Equity is the vehicle that you use to get students to that point. So what does it look like? I mean, in leadership, it means that you have to be able to, as I've mentioned, you have to be able to analyze what you're doing at a school system level and make decisions. Is this equitable for all of our students or not? It also means that from an equity perspective, you should be looking at who's on your team. Because as superintendents, we're not lone rangers. Well, let me put it this way. I've known some lone rangers that don't last very long. Mm. So you're only as good as your team. But does your team reflect the very students that you're serving? Mm. And on all levels, I'm not only talking about racial, I'm talking about gender. I'm talking about, do you have representation from the LGBTQ community? Do you have English language learner representation? So, you know, the more students see themselves in positions of leadership, my experience has been that the more that they see themselves as academics, they see themselves as learners. So leadership is really, really important when it comes to equity. You mentioned creating a mental model that's rooted in equity. Again, if you're doing what you need to do to have students meet the bar that you've set, then all of your systems, all of your structures, all of your processes should be in service of that vehicle that you call your equity vehicle to get students to meet the bar that you've set. And that's oftentimes harder to do than to say, because it means that you're going to have to stop doing some things that perhaps have been done for generations and generations. I can recall when I got to New York City, I wasn't born in New York City. I used to tell people, and people really were proud of the fact that, hey, I'm a born New Yorker. I was born and my grandfather was and my great grandfather. And like, I think that's beautiful. But I would remind people, I'm a New Yorker by choice. So I've chosen to come to New York City. But I remember that when I came to New York City and I started looking and seeing these blatantly discriminatory systems and structures, and they literally called them what they were. They're screens. So there's screens in the elementary school and screens at the middle school. I don't know about you, but in Texas, we have screens to keep the bugs out. So why do we have screens to keep kids out? And that's exactly what they did. That's exactly what they did. They kept certain kids out of certain elementary schools, certain kids out of certain middle schools, and they called them screens. And everybody just had screens. And here I am thinking, wait a minute, we call them screens. They function like screens. What's the academic purpose of the screen? Oh, well, these are very sought after schools. Well, yeah, because you're cherry picking all your kids. So why do we do it? Well, it's just always been that way. Well, but why? What's the research base? Where's the literature? Mm-hmm. Where else in the country do we do it like this? Like, why are we the only ones that do it this way? How do we get so smart? You know, and nobody could answer the question. But it was a matter of the mental model was rooted in that particular way of doing things. It was so rooted that people didn't even really think about the fact that these are screens to keep kids out. It's just the way you apply to an elementary school. In a public school, by the way, you're applying to an elementary school. Don't get me started.
Richard, I can tell you this, and for our participants in today's podcast, anybody that is an educational leader, Richard, I don't think we will look at the word screens or universal screens the same anymore. And that is great. If there's one thing that they can take out of this, Richard, is yes, universal screens keep kids out. We know the functionality of the regular screen. Oh, that is just great. Continue, Richard, please.
Yeah, screens keep kids and bugs out. So just remember that. So again, there are systems and structures that just get rooted in inequitable practices, but it's just the way it is. And people say, well, that's just the way it is to apply to schools in New York City, or, you know, substitute New York City for any other school system in America that have these types of systems and structures. I think that, you know, historically as well, it's really, really important to understand what happens in local communities. You know, I live in San Antonio, Texas. And, you know, when you're in San Antonio, right around the seventh grade in our local curriculum, kids start learning about the Alamo. And, you know, Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone and, you know, the Alamo, and, you know, these men died at the Alamo, and they were fending off all of these Mexicans. Well, it's been really fascinating that as I have conversations with older generations of Latinos here in San Antonio, very informally, dinner parties, backyard gigs, they almost universally talk about how beautiful the community is. And it's a great community. But that right around the seventh grade is when they first started feeling the pangs of racial discord. And it coincided, I think not coincidentally, with the fact that around seventh grade, they start learning about the Alamo, and those bad Mexicans killed all those Americans defending the Alamo. So all of a sudden, kids that they've grown up with that are not Mexican-American, all of a sudden, seventh grade, start learning about the Mexicans that killed Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone and David Bowie. So that's part of the curriculum. And I think you have to ask the question, are we teaching it the way it should be taught? Are we teaching history in a way that is our history, or is somebody else's history that's being communicated in a certain way? You can substitute that dynamic for lots of different dynamics in terms of the curriculum that our kids learn that are not culturally relevant or uplifting. And that goes to the fourth thing, the classroom instruction. So how do you teach that? I think one of the biggest red herrings right now is this whole, critical race theory conversation. No school in America is teaching critical race theory except law schools in Ivy Leagues. It's a law school conversation, but it's a very particular conversation that has to do with legal concepts. But it's being usurped to talk about things that I think we should be talking about, like culturally relevant sustaining education, culturally relevant materials, representation in books and in history and in literature. of all facets of the American experience. So again, I think in those four areas that I've just kind of gone on and on about, there's a lot to unpack in terms of what is contributing to that Jeffersonian model that sometimes we don't even recognize because that's just the way it is.
Yeah. And you know what, Richard, what I hope is that we know of the great work of the meta-analyses of Hattie, right? Which again, I hope that one day we'll be able to look at a meta-analysis that has culturally relevance embedded into the statistical variables to look at now what is the true impact on Black or Brown students with the effect size of those strategies that he mentioned. Yeah. But anyway, that is another conversation. But you had touched upon this, Richard, right? And I think that you, when you talk about now unwrapping this from an asynchronous manner, right? This is point six of direct instruction. We want them to go back and to be able to unpack and unwrap what you're saying, specifically around culturally responsive practices, culturally relevant pedagogy, right? Just the perspective of one providing their monologue of what history, American history, is perceived to be, right? You touched upon critical race theory, which again is a law class, which I don't know how it evolved into the pre-K-8 sector, which I'm still trying to figure out. But more importantly, when you look at that, right? When you hear about wokeness, right? The word woke. If you remember the historical context of woke, comes from the Black community, where woke always meant watch out, the police is around. I don't understand how wokeness became the definition of that. So anyway, all these political stuff that just takes another life of itself, that I think that in my opinion is rooted in racism when you think about it, right? So well, but go ahead, Richard. Yeah, please elaborate.
No. Yeah, I was just going to say that's cultural appropriation. And I'll give you even a little more detail on woke. So woke goes back to the days where jazz musicians were traveling in the 1920s. And they would travel through certain communities where they obviously couldn't go to restaurants, they couldn't sleep in the hotel, where they literally were risking their lives on the streets in those communities. And amongst those jazz musicians, they would say to each other, hey, you got to stay woke. In other words, don't fall asleep. You got to stay woke. And now that has been usurped and appropriated in a very different way for very political reasons. So it's important for us to just know that, so that if we know, you know, now that you know, like Biggie Small used to say, right? Now that you know, you know. And I think that more than anything, it's important for us. Look, we are in a people business. We don't sell things. We don't sell widgets. We educate souls. So the way we come into the space with children is really, really important. And when you talk about how you come into a space with children, it's important that children feel uplifted. It's important that children feel like you believe in them. And, you know, there's a little meme that I would send out every year at the beginning of the school year, at the beginning of every semester. And I would send it as a principal. I would send it to my teachers, as a superintendent. I would say, send it to the entire district. And it very simply said, my teacher thought I was smarter than I was. So I was. Now, when you think about that, that's the power that we have as teachers. So if you inadvertently are walking into a classroom without any malice, but inadvertently walking into a classroom, and what you say, what you do, how you organize is giving kids a message that perhaps you don't believe in them, then I would think as an enlightened educator, I'd want to know that so that I could work on that, because now that I know, I know. And in New York City, we actually did something about that called implicit bias training. You would have thought we were trying to go after motherhood and apple pie, right? Mm-hmm. Implicit bias. I am not a racist. Nobody says you're a racist, but we all have our blind spots. And if we have a way that we can talk about our blind spots that doesn't imply a certain level of racism, that's not what we're talking about. Do I have a blind spot? Yes, I do. Do I have blind spots? Yes, I do. And Brother Michael, if you see me operating in my blind spot, now you and I have the language, the vernacular, to be able for you to be able to call me and say, Richard, I just want to point out, this is what you say, and this is how it comes across. We now can have that conversation instead of, Richard, I don't know how to tell you, but you know, that's kind of racist what you're saying. We have to get beyond this.
Absolutely.
The tribalism that exists around education just isn't helping us undo that Jeffersonian model.
Absolutely. And Richard, when you highlight implicit bias, right? And it is, and how you and I are how we broker our equity work. You know, we just say, I mean, how you eloquently put it, I just say, you got to call it out, right? But you call mm-hmm. out in a way that is grounded, level setting, learning for both, right? How I can be able to strengthen my ability to be able to have that conversation, that courageous conversation with regards to identify some of those targeted blind spots. Because if we don't identify those blind spots, then we're just perpetuating a gap or exacerbating a gap with regards to the students that we service, with regards to our leaders that are Black and Brown leaders who also have experiences as well. But Richard, you know, doing this work, right? And doing this work, let's be honest, chances are you're going to be out of that position shortly, right? Mm-hmm. And we're seeing a high level of turnover of really high quality, high effective superintendents and leaders just leaving after a traumatic event. But that traumatic event is just grounded on the work that we've just been talking about for the past 45 minutes. So Richard, how do you bounce back from, I like to say, perceived mm-hmm. failure after a traumatic event as a leader? And again, you know how we as superintendents, we take it to heart because we want to impact all. But there's that perceived failure in the public that is generated through the news, through social media, whatever it is. But it's not really failure. It's really moving the work of changing the status quo structures. But those leaders that have experienced this over the past 18 to 24 months, how do you bounce back from that, Richard? Because we still need good, effective leaders in the public sector work.
Yeah. Some thoughts on that. I think by way of context, I talked about tribalism, you know, the polarization that's happening in the political sphere in America is really right now being ground at the local level in school board races. You're really starting to see that polarization, and that's just incredibly hard for superintendents. I know, as you do, many of our colleagues that are doing great work, are really moving the needle academically, socially, emotionally in their school system.
Absolutely.
So that's really traumatizing for superintendents. You know, people, I always used to joke, and it's no joke anymore, you know, we're all just one school board meeting away from being the past superintendent.
Yeah.
And we're starting to see that happen quite a bit. But more directly to your question, you know, it's been about a year and a half since I stepped down in New York City. And I just have to be honest, it was a year and a half of healing. I had to heal. You know, when you go into education, you go into education to help people. You want to help students. You want to help make institutions better. And then to get pounded in the media, to get pounded by the naysayers, and you get called names, and you get death threats, and you get envelopes with white powder mailed to your house, and you have people showing up with bullhorns outside of your apartment, calling you all kinds of names. I think we put on our urban superintendent outfit and our armor, and we go out there and we, you know, smile and still do the job. But internally, after a while, that just wears on you. It just wears mm-hmm. on your psyche. It wears on your personal, because that's not who you are. And you can tell yourself, they don't know me. They don't know who I am. They don't know. Mm-hmm. That doesn't matter. But after a while, it just really wears you down. So my advice to my colleagues would be this: make sure you know who you are. Make sure you know who you are. And every morning when you get up and you're brushing your teeth and you're combing your hair, you say, good morning, beautiful. Good morning, handsome. I know who you are. And it's not what they say you are, right? Mm-hmm. You have to keep telling yourself that. If you're fortunate enough to have, you know, your family there with you, make time for your family, because the job can become all-encompassing. And that becomes a dangerous part when your job becomes all-encompassing and you don't make time for those that you love, and more importantly, that love you. That contributes to that, I would say, drain of energy that happens in the job. And then, you know, I always, for good or bad, I always would say to folks, and I still say to superintendents now, don't be so busy keeping your job that you don't do your job. And by that, I mean, you're going to be put in situations that are going to be very difficult, where you're going to have to make decisions based on, okay, do I acquiesce to the status quo that I know is not serving all kids, but it's going to make 2, 3, 4 board members happy, or the loudest complainers in the community, they're going to quiet down? Or do I stick to what I know is right, what I can prove is right, but it's going to be difficult because you have those 2, 3, 4 board members, or you have those loud voices in the community? And I'll tell you what, none of us were born superintendents. None of us are going to die superintendents. The only thing that we're going to have is our integrity. That's all. So when you're not a superintendent, you will have your integrity if you keep your integrity. So don't be so busy keeping your job that you don't do your job, because if you do your job, you will keep your integrity, and that's what matters. And then the third thing that I would say is, look, there is a life after the superintendency. And, you know, I've been away for a year and a half, but I have to be honest, I know that one day I will somewhere be a superintendent again, because it's a calling, but I needed to heal, and I've healed. I have a little joke I tell too. I say, you know, people say, man, the superintendency, especially during COVID, like, how did you do it? And you were leading the biggest school system in the world, and how'd that happen? And I said, I slept like a baby. I said, what? You slept like a baby? How? I said, really simple. I hit the bottle, go to bed, wake up crying, hit the bottle again, go back to bed.
Oh,
but that's actually something else. You have to have a sense of humor. You just got to keep a sense of humor, because if not, it'll drive you crazy.
Absolutely. But you know what, Richard, I'll tell you, when you said know who you are, right? That is... that should hit a chord for everyone, especially our participants for this episode, because there's going to be a lot of, I like to say, in the data sense, right? There's going to be a lot of noise that's going to try to deter you away from the actual signals of the data, right? Mm-hmm. But don't be so busy trying to keep your job, right? That you're so worried about keeping your job from not preventing you from doing your job with a high level of integrity. And Richard, this has just absolutely been an honor to have you here. But I think you heard it first on Voices for Excellence. Richard Carranza has not officially hung up the shoes for the superintendency. So you heard it here first, everybody. Richard Carranza is available, right? Oh my God. So, Richard, I know all too well about that healing. And thank you so much for coming on. Truly, again, this is an honor, appreciative of the leadership strategies, as well as I like to call the nuggets that everybody can apply. And as always, Richard, I think I will be seeing you this week in Orlando. Yes. Yes, you will be there. So we will be getting together soon. My brother, mi hermano, good to have you on, Richard.
It's been an honor. And to everyone out there listening, you know, God bless you. Keep doing God's work, because that's what it is in education. It's God's work. But it's been an honor to spend time with you. And we'll see you around the block.
I see you around the block. Thank you, Richard. Onward and upward, everybody. Take care. Thanks, Richard. Take care. Thanks, Serena. Thanks, Abby.
I think that's a wrap.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, everyone.
Take care. I'll see you this week, Richard. Bye-bye.
See you there. Bye-bye.
Bye.